From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents around the globe. I'm Martha Wexler. This week, we remember an anti-communist human rights champion and the communist dictator of the world's most repressive state. Also, the drug trade comes to Costa Rica, and an uprising in a Chinese village. The world lost a great moral leader this past week. Playwright Václav Havel was one of the foremost champions of human rights in Eastern Europe. In 1989, he directed the Velvet Revolution that brought down Czechoslovakia's communist regime, and he went on to become president of his nation. Havel died Sunday at the age of 75 after a long illness. NPR's Silvio Poggioli has this remembrance.
Václav Havel was born in 1936 to a middle-class family. During the Stalinist 50s, his bourgeois background earned him treatment as a class enemy and narrowed his educational options. Havel became interested in drama, and his first job was as a theater stagehand. He soon rose to directing and writing plays, most notably The Garden Party, which was his first international success. But his career ended abruptly with the 1968 Soviet-led invasion of Czechoslovakia. After that, his works circulated only in the underground, within the small circle of Czechoslovak dissidents. Often arrested, imprisoned, and harassed by police, Havel became the outstanding symbol of resistance to the regime.
Čínská lidová republika, obrovitá země, Mao Zedong.
One of Havel's least known works, the collage of radio clips, Czech Lands, My Beautiful Czech Lands, was written after the 1968 invasion. By juxtaposing politician speeches, music, cheering crowds, and the banal sounds of humanity, Havel shows how political rhetoric has deprived words of their meaning. Totalitarian society has morally destroyed the individual. His message was the need to restore the real meaning of words in order, as he often said, to be able to live within the truth. As in all his works, he denounced the absurdities of totalitarian regimes, but also the apathy of a society which never rebelled against its oppressors. At the end of 1989, after two decades of torpor, Czechoslovak society finally woke up and poured into the streets to demonstrate. Almost overnight, the regime was swept aside. And the underdogs, that small group of dissident intellectuals led by Havel, were elevated from their kitchens to the Prague Castle, the seat of the Czechoslovak presidency. 2 months later, in February 1990, Havel, the president, addressed a joint session of the U.S. Congress. His speech touched on his favorite theme, the primacy of morality in the public sphere. And, speaking through the official interpreter, he said all citizens share a responsibility.
Responsibility to something higher than my family, my country, my company, my success. Responsibility to the order of being, where all our actions are indelibly recorded, and where and only where they will be properly judged.
Ever the nonconformist, the president was often seen in a t-shirt and carrying a backpack. An early visitor to the castle was Frank Zappa, one of Havel's best friends. But Havel faced many difficulties in reconciling politics and his moral principles in a society that was trying to free itself from the social and psychological mindset of communism. His legislative proposals were often rejected by parliamentary deputies, who simply paid lip service to what Havel stood for, but didn't share his experience of sacrifices as a dissident. Less than 1,000 days after Havel was elected Czechoslovak president, Slovak nationalists defeated his bid for re-election, and the civic movement, the political party he had inspired, was voted out of parliament. The republics of the federation split into two new countries. Havel was later twice elected president of the new Czech Republic, but his popularity waned. His critics accused him of being an amateur, whose emphasis on morality and politics alienated public opinion. In a 1993 interview at the Prague Castle, Havel acknowledged that he had often failed to translate his moral message into political action. But he pointed out that throughout East and Central Europe, the intellectuals who guided their countries out of communism no longer enjoyed popular support.
In most cases, people in these societies just tried to survive or to adapt during the totalitarian period. And that is why they found it difficult to identify themselves with those who were bold enough to take risks and who challenged the apathy of a large part of society.
Jan Urban was a spokesman of the Civic Forum, the movement founded by Havel that toppled communism. Urban admits that under the totalitarian regime, Czechoslovak dissidents were isolated from the people. There was a large gap between the dissidents' willingness to take a moral stance and the passivity of society at large. Urban says Havel failed to understand that politics is the art of bargaining and compromise.
People are eager to hear moral message, but you cannot build politics on a moral message only. You have to just know that it's a craft with its traditions, that you need to talk to all factions on a scene, and that you have to build consensus, you have to build majority behind your program. It's about independent judiciary, it's about parliament, it's about constitutional court, and all these independent media, and all these small and long-term projects you have to work on. It's not just that you are a god somewhere on the top of the mountain, coming down from time to time with a big message and coming, going back again.
Havel's writings after the fall of communism were proof of his anguish in trying to reconcile his moral principles with the pragmatic requirements of governing. Adjusting to the art of the possible was a difficult task for a man who had spent all his formative years on the margins of communist society. And he became more and more impatient with a populace which would not assert itself and tended toward inertia and conformity. But Havel refused to be a pessimist. In his 1992 book, Summer Meditations, he said the main goal of politics in his country is the moral reconstruction of a society devastated by the immorality of communism. And he said he would continue to knock his head against the wall to prove that politics cannot exist without morality. Reflecting on his political experiences in the 1993 interview, Havel said he had learned to be more patient and that he had also learned the difference between the intellectual and the politician.
The intellectual can produce a finished product, while the work of a politician is a never-ending process which must constantly adapt to the changing needs of society.
Václav Havel, the dissident Czech playwright turned president. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News.
The other world figure who died this week was the antithesis of Václav Havel. North Korea's Kim Jong-il ran a brutal totalitarian regime. Much of the world saw him as a delusional dictator, responsible for a famine that killed a million of his own people. NPR's Anthony Kuhn says Kim was also a political survivor who managed to hold his own in a high-stakes game of nuclear poker.
North Korea's Lodestar 2 satellite, which it claims it launched in April of 2009, broadcasts an electronic version of the song of General Kim Jong-il, transmitting the dear leader's cult of personality to the far reaches of outer space. The sound of praise for our general spreads atop Mount Baekdu and all over beautiful Korea, proclaims another version of the song, Hail, Hail, General Kim Jong-il. Kim's official biographers say that he was born on Mount Baekdu, the mythic origin of the Korean race. In fact, he was born in 1942 in the Russian Far East, where his father, Kim Il-sung, was waging guerrilla warfare against Japanese occupation of Korea. Given Kim Il-sung's stature and charisma as North Korea's founding father, Kim Jong-il was at a disadvantage from the start.
Kim Jong-il has been more than a front man, but less than the totalitarian leader that his father was, able to just issue diktats and do whatever he wanted to do.
Selig Harrison, a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., met twice with Kim Il-sung. He says that Kim Jong-il was not the natural-born political animal his father was. Kim Jong-il was the son of Kim Il-sung's first wife. His second wife wanted her eldest son to be heir, not Kim Jong-il. Many of the old guard within the ruling Workers' Party, meanwhile, felt a dynastic succession from one Kim to the next was uncommunist.
I think this had a lot to do with making him a very defensive, manipulative, cunning operator who did eventually get his father's nod as the heir who faced a tremendous opposition from within the Workers' Party.
The death of his father in 1994 thrust Kim Jong-il into the spotlight. The following year, economic collapse plunged the country into roughly 3 years of famine that killed more than 2 million people. B.R. Myers is head of the International Studies Department at Dongseo University in South Korea. He says that even with the regime's many tools of repression, it's amazing that Kim was able to prevent a massive exodus of starving refugees.
When he took over the country in 1994, with the economy already in free fall and the country really having lost its main benefactor in the Soviet Union, and when you think that we were all predicting North Korea's downfall within 1 or 2 years back then, I mean, when you think how well he played that card, it really is quite extraordinary.
The late Hwang Jang-yop was Kim Jong-il's mentor and a top Workers' Party official until he defected to South Korea in 1997. He remained a harsh critic of his former bosses until his death last year. But he recalled that even at the height of the famine, Kim commanded intense loyalty from many North Koreans. Hwang remembered visiting a North Korean logistics officer during the crisis.
What did he say, do you know? He said, is General Kim okay? Please do your best to take good care of him. We are okay to die of hunger. He was insane.
Kim responded to the famine by launching some limited economic reforms, including the Jangmadang, or private markets for food and daily necessities, which the state-run economy could no longer adequately provide. He also stepped up diplomatic engagement, leading to the first inter-Korean summit in 2000. In a 2009 interview shortly before his death, former South Korean President Kim Dae-jung recalls that Kim Jong-il, the dictator, was abhorrent. But Kim, the summit host, was a far cry from the foreign media caricature of Kim as Dr. Evil in a leisure suit, platform shoes, and a bouffant hairdo.
I, U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and Swedish Prime Minister Göran Persson all met with Secretary Kim Jong-il. We shared similar impressions of meeting him. He was smart and a quick problem solver. He was also witty and humorous. Our overall impression was very different from the way he was known to the outside world.
Wendy Sherman was a special advisor to President Bill Clinton on North Korea, and she accompanied then-Secretary of State Albright to Pyongyang in 2001. She sat next to Kim at a stadium to watch a huge festival of synchronized dancing. Sherman says she turned to Kim and said,
Mr. Chairman, I have the sense that in some other life you were a great director because he clearly took such delight in putting these performances together. And he said, yes. He cared about this a great deal. He owned every Academy Award movie. He had watched them all. He also had every film of Michael Jordan's NBA basketball games and had watched them as well.
North Korea announced it tested its first atomic bomb in 2006. Pyongyang then played the nuclear card in a game of brinksmanship. It promised to disarm, but then backtracked if it felt slighted or wanted more political and economic benefits in return. President George W. Bush maligned Kim Jong-il as a moral pygmy and placed North Korea squarely on his so-called axis of evil along with Iran and Iraq.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction. These regimes pose a grave and growing danger.
Pyongyang pointed to Washington's rhetoric as evidence that the U.S. was poised to attack the North or seek regime change. Kim Jong-il used the threat of U.S. hostility, meanwhile, to divert domestic attention from economic hardships. Zhang Liangui is a North Korea expert at the Chinese Communist Party's Central Party School in Beijing. Zhang says Kim's reading of his regional opponents was spot on, and he was effective in exploiting the differences among them.
North Korea is a small and weak country, yet Kim was able to manipulate so many big countries in its hand. Kim made the other countries in the six-party talks dance to his tune, and there was nothing the other parties could do about it.
In other words, North Korea is a small country shaped by the big powers surrounding it, China, Russia, Japan, and the U.S. But Korea's geostrategic position in Asia is such that a shrewd tactician, perhaps with a little nuclear clout, can turn the peninsula into a tail that wags quite a few dogs. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Beijing.
Coming up, the rough neighborhood of Central America. Drug cartels tarnish the region's jewel. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Martha Wexler. Costa Rica is a peaceful nation that abolished its army in 1948. It's known as Central America's most stable democracy, and that reputation has helped Costa Rica draw nearly 1 million U.S. tourists every year. But Costa Rica also sits right in the middle of the world's busiest corridor for cocaine trafficking, and this highly lucrative drug trade is now threatening its idyllic image. Nick Miroff has this report.
Jim Damalas is one of 60,000 or so U.S. expatriates living in Costa Rica. He left a career in the L.A. advertising business to build an award-winning hotel with sweeping views of the Pacific and its own rainforest preserve.
So back in here, this area is full of primates, and we bring a lot of the students here.
Damalas' resort, Si Komono, outside the tiny town of Capos, has every sort of green certification you can imagine, even building tree bridges for the local monkeys to swing safely across the road. All of this, and Costa Rica's entire tourism-dependent economy, has been possible largely because of its reputation as a safe place that isn't like the rest of Central America.
People say in Costa Rica, God's always watching over us. We don't have a lot of hurricanes. We don't have devastating earthquakes. We don't have devastating poverty. Instead of having tanks and military, we have teachers and schools. But because there's no military and a police force that's never had to be militarized, we are very vulnerable.
Recent polls show that crime and security are the leading public concern now in this country of 4.6 million. The same laid-back attitude and openness to outsiders that draws tourists has also attracted Mexican cartels and their Colombian cocaine suppliers, who warehouse drug loads here and move them up the coastlines or overland toward the U.S. Local contacts are increasingly paid in raw product for their logistical help. So drug use has jumped, especially crack cocaine, and Costa Rica's homicide rate has nearly doubled since 2004.
I do not remember in our whole history a menace as this menace with organized crime.
Laura Chinchilla is Costa Rica's first female president. She says that Costa Rica's view of itself as a peaceful, law-abiding country in a poor, violent region is now being put to the test by a threat far greater than even the conflicts of the Cold War era.
During the 80s, you had forces fighting in the region, but they have a structure, and they have an ideology. They were fighting for different ways of conducting the society. The problem was a political problem. This has to do with the survival of the institution. It doesn't matter if it's from the left or from the right. It doesn't matter which kind of ideology your government has.
Authorities here say recent arrests of police officers on corruption charges show the institutions are standing up to the power of the cartels, but Chinchilla and others acknowledge the fight is only beginning. For the United States, there is also a great deal at stake here, as Washington's counter-drug role in the region expands. Costa Rica is still nowhere near as violent as Honduras or El Salvador, where the murder rate is more than six times higher. But there is a sense that the cartel's criminal expansion has to be checked somewhere. Costa Rican Coast Guard Lieutenant Rodolfo Murillo unfurls a map of the country and its long, jagged Pacific coast. The walls are still bare here at the agency's brand new Pacific headquarters at Puerto Caldera, built with $3 million in U.S. funding. With the decline of local fisheries and new catch restrictions, Murillo says the fishermen have turned to running million-dollar coke packages for the cartels. They pay well, Murillo says, explaining how locals bring drug loads to shore or deliver gasoline out to sea for traffickers zooming north from Colombia in high-powered speedboats. The new docks here, creaking in the waves, have two berths for U.S.-donated interceptor boats designed to chase down the smugglers. The Coast Guard hasn't had any on the Pacific until now, but already officials say the smugglers are changing tactics to stay two steps ahead of authorities. They're hiding cocaine deep in the wells of fishing trawlers and building sophisticated semi-submersibles that cruise undetected far out at sea, well beyond the range of the new boats. For NPR News, I'm Nick Muroff.
And Nick filed that story with support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. To southern China now, where the village of Wuhan was the site of a popular uprising against local communist authorities. Police and paramilitary troops sealed off the village, but NPR's Louisa Lim was one of the few journalists to make it in. She sent us this report.
It's all been sold, says the motorbike driver, waving at a huge swathe of green fields as we drive through Wuhan. These words are repeated again and again. The villagers here accuse local officials of selling 6.5 square miles of land to boost government coffers. They say it happened without compensation for the villagers, who didn't even realize their land had been sold. We used to survive on our land, says my driver. Now we have nothing left. Chickens are smuggled in for food at the villagers' barricade. Because police have sealed off the village, residents are having to sneak in supplies. The villagers have blocked the roads with tree trunks and strewn them with broken glass and piles of bricks to throw, should the authorities move in. So far, four villagers have been named as criminal suspects. One has died in police custody. Another of those named, Lin Zulian, says they can't back down now.
I will not regret, even if I die, for the interests of the villagers. It is the party's obligation and everybody's obligation to fight corruption. To do so, we must use the weapons provided by the legal system to fight to the end.
Lin Zulian is not a natural rebel. He joined the Communist Party in 1965 and was a village official for 8 years. But he can no longer stand by and watch.
It has been 20 years of loss, and it is not just the villagers' loss. It is besmirching the face of China's Communist Party.
At the village square, thousands of people, young and old, gather to shout slogans, an extraordinary sight in China. They yell, "Down with corruption," but also, "Long live the Communist Party." They're planning a big march on Wednesday, but these villagers emphasize they don't want to overthrow the Communist Party. They're just against corrupt local officials, and they think the central government can save them. That's what Wang Wentao, who's watching the rally, had been hoping too. But he was imprisoned twice after trying to petition the central government about his village's plight. He's from Xintuo, 6 miles away, where a plot of land the size of 37 soccer fields has been requisitioned. Wang says Wukan's tactics wouldn't work in his village.
We couldn't do this because too many people have been bought off by our local village chief. He won people over by paying them.
And this is another warning not to follow Wukan's lead. The local television channel is on a constant loop. It accuses Wukan's representatives of organizing riots and disrupting public order. In Longguang village, just 4 miles away, farmers take me to see the land they say was stolen from them 16 years ago. It's a vast plot the size of 55 soccer fields. It's never been built upon. In September, 1,000 angry villagers knocked down the surrounding wall to reclaim it. They remember that day with pride and fear.
Officials said we knocked down the wall illegally and that we're an illegal organization. Now they want to arrest our village representatives. We are very scared.
That was a villager who asked for his name to be withheld for fear of the consequences. The anger at land grabs is not just local, it's national. Official figures show more than 40 million Chinese farmers have lost land, with 2 million more being dispossessed every year. Here in Wukan, it's come to a head. And the fact that so many villages here have their own grievances could push the authorities towards a hardline solution. Louisa Lim, NPR News.
You've been listening to Foreign Dispatch. For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, look for more international stories by clicking on News and World. I'm Martha Wexler, NPR News.